Good afternoon. My name's Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform, and on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program to examine the affordability factor, if you will, the extent to which the reform plans being considered by Congress would make decent health care coverage more affordable for different groups of Americans. And it sounds like a fairly straightforward topic, but you're about to see it has an awful lot of moving parts. It involves market-based tools like an insurance exchange. It involves government subsidies to both families and to businesses, insurance reforms, and a whole lot of other stuff you're going to be hearing about. And of course, it involves different approaches and different spending levels in the House-passed bill and the one soon to be considered by the Senate, we think. It's also a topic that hasn't gotten the attention we think that it deserves. It's not an inflammatory social issue. Now, there are surely areas of controversy, and I'm sure you're going to hear about them today, but mostly it's a question of numbers. How much will different folks pay, and for what, and comparing that to what they would have had to pay if there were no reform legislation? Now, some of you may have seen a piece this week in the Columbia Journalism Review blog by veteran writer Trudy Lieberman on how this topic is being covered by her fellow journalists. And I think it's worth quoting a couple of sentences, if you'll bear with me. Here's what she had to say. The media, she said, have talked about affordability mostly in the context of whether the country can afford reform. It's easier for a reporter to write about humongous numbers like $900 billion or $1 trillion and give the arguments that those sums will or won't add to the federal deficit than it is to spend several hours with the Joneses in Peoria finding out where in the family budget they're going to find $8,000 to pay for health insurance. Now, that's not the only affordability concern that's raised and addressed in this reform debate, but it's certainly one that we are all concerned about. Now, our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing is the Commonwealth Fund, which has both commissioned and done some very good analysis of the reform bills as they are emerging. You'll hear from my co-moderator, Rachel Newsom, in just a second. A couple of logistic concerns. A lot of background information in your packets, including speaker bios and PowerPoint presentations when we have them, although we may have had superseded PowerPoint presentations, and Rachel will say more about that in a moment. On Monday, you'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing along with the copies of the materials you have in your packets. That's on KFF.org. I'll spit it out in just a second. And the electronic versions of the materials you can get on our website, allhealth.org, and a few days after that, you'll find a transcript available. Green question cards in your packets you can use at the appropriate time following the presentations. There are also some microphones that you can use to voice your question, and there is a blue evaluation form that we'd ask you to fill out. And if you've been to a lot of these briefings, you might not bother looking at it. We actually have a different question that we want you to address on that form. So if you would take a look at it and share your views with us, we'd appreciate it. What I'd like to do is to introduce our entire distinguished panel, if I could, at the same time. The first panelist we'll hear from is Sarah Collins, the Vice President for Affordable Health Insurance at the Commonwealth Fund. She's an economist, lengthy list of publishing credits and congressional testimony. She's been an editor of U.S. News. She also happens to be the lead author of a paper that is forthcoming, analyzing various aspects of the proposals as they now look in the House and the Senate, and has spent most of the last 48 hours furiously revising her slides in the wake of the introduction of the new Senate reform bill on Wednesday. Then we'll hear from Stuart Butler, Vice President of Domestic and Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Stuart's completing his third decade at Heritage, and he's well into his second decade as a panelist at Alliance Events, I'm pleased to say. He describes healthcare as his abiding passion, and advocates a reform of the U.S. system based on consumer choice and state-led innovation. And then finally, we'll hear from Deanne Freedholm, who's leader of the health reform team at Consumers Union. In her earlier incarnations, she served as Medicaid director for the state of Texas and commissioner of the state's Department of Health and Human Services. She's helped the government of South Africa reform its social grant program, and she's been part of the respected health policy consulting group, Health Management Associates. And we're going to turn first to Rachel Newsom. She's a senior policy director for the Commonwealth Fund and for its Commission on a High-Performance Health System. Many of you may know Rachel from her days on the staff of Senator Cantwell a few years ago. And let's get started. Rachel, glad to have you with us.
Great. Thank you so much, Ed. And we're pleased to be here to partner with the Alliance for Health Reform on this really important topic. Just when I think we can't get better at kind of identifying the topic for the given time, we hit another one kind of right at the right time. So thanks to Ed and his staff for helping us to identify the right topics for the question of the day. In September, the Census Bureau reported that 46.3 million people lacked health insurance in 2008, and we know that another 25 million insured working-age adults face out-of-pocket health care costs that are so high they qualify as being underinsured. We also know that the high cost of health care is a burden that faces the uninsured and the insured alike. 80 million adults with insurance and without reported difficulties paying for coverage and for actually going without coverage because of the inability to pay. We know that healthcare coverage isn't the same as healthcare, but we do know that the two are linked together, and having coverage clearly impacts the ability to access the system, the quality of the care that you receive, and the financial burden placed on the individual, the community, and the nation. Our discussion today focuses on the issue of affordability. Indeed, even the highest quality healthcare isn't effective if it's inaffordable. The work you'll see presented here today is a part of a body of work that the fund has been doing to analyze the leading reform bills and help gauge their impact. And that work is led by Sarah Collins, who you'll hear from in just a moment. On our website, you'll find the forthcoming reports on how the bills deal with coverage and affordability, as well as system and payment reforms, provisions, and overviews of the legislation and how far they go to achieving a system of high performance. And the angels are back. So I need to say one comment about the slides. As Ed mentioned, these have been frantically being revised in the last 24 hours. The slides that you'll see on the screen have been updated and are accurate, which is helpful in this one since almost no one can read it. But the handouts in your packet are a little bit outdated. We will point out when there are pieces that have yet to be updated. There's one specific area on this chart and in the individual mandate when it talks about the level of the hardship exemption in the Senate bill, and that should read 8%, not 9.8. I believe your handouts say 9.8, and Sarah will talk a little bit more about that as we get into this. But while much has been made of the differences between the bills and the areas of controversy, many of the essential elements are similar in the House and the Senate approaches. While there are substantive differences between the two bills, both would preserve the current mixed public-private system and build on the parts of our system that work well, the large employer model, Medicaid, and SCHIP. Both bills also seek to improve the parts of the system that are not functioning optimally, the small and non-group markets. Both bills would enact new rules for the private insurance market. Pre-existing conditions could no longer be a reason for denial of coverage, and everyone that applied for coverage would now be accepted. Both the House and Senate bill establish a new insurance exchange that would offer the choice of both public and private plans that meet the requirements set forth by the exchange. All individuals would be required to have insurance under both the House and the Senate bills, and premium assistance is offered to help with the costs. Again, Sarah will go into more detail on how each bill handles the individual requirement and the subsidies available. In addition to expanding coverage, the bills are estimated to reduce the federal deficit over the 10-year period 2010 to 2019. In the Senate, the cost of improving and expanding coverage was offset by system savings of $491 billion over 10 and new revenue, including the excise tax on high-cost health plans. In the House, the cost of coverage expansion is also offset by savings from delivery system and payment system reforms, in addition to new revenue sources, including the surtax on high-income households. We're in a historical window of opportunity to advance reform. The President laid out his principles for reform early this year, and the committees of jurisdiction have reported out bills that meet these principles, ensuring stability and security of coverage for those who have it, providing coverage for those who do not, and slowing the rate of health care cost growth for families, employers, and government. The Commonwealth Fund's Commission on a High-Performance Health System has also laid out an integrated set of policies needed to move our system towards one of high performance and has included that coverage for all is not just a moral imperative. It's actually the economic cornerstone of health care delivery reform. If done right, covering the uninsured can be the key to aggressive health care cost containment by making it possible to change the way we pay for care and limit spending growth without concerns of excluding the most vulnerable from needed care or undermining essential components of our system. Reforming our health system is not an easy task, and at roughly $900 billion over 10 years, it's certainly not cheap. However, the cost of reform needs to be considered in the context of total health system spending, which is roughly $35 trillion over the same time period. If the investment can improve the efficiency of the system, returns can more than offset the federal investment. Now we'll turn to Sarah to discuss the coverage and affordability provisions in the House and Senate bills.
Sarah? And I should say that the revised slides will be posted on our website as soon as we get back to our office after the briefing.
So thank you so much, Ed and Rachel. I'm going to focus again, as Rachel said, on the implications of these of the two different bills on coverage and also premium costs and out of pocket spending. These are the most recent estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, and as you can see, both bills would substantially decrease the number of people who are uninsured, increasing coverage to about 94% and to 96% of the of legal residents in the country, reducing the number of uninsured from 30 to 36 million people. So major effect on the uninsured. The bills also provide protection from premium costs for low and moderate income families in several different ways. Number one, major increases in eligibility for Medicaid, increasing eligibility to 133% under the Senate bill and 150% in the House bill. New federal regulations that address problems that people have and small businesses have in the individual and small group markets, restrictions against underwriting, no rescissions, and also no lifetime limits or annual limits on benefits, what plans will pay for benefits, and importantly, minimum benefit standards through the exchange. So people know what they're getting when they're purchasing a plan now. Right now, you often don't know what you're getting when you buy a plan on the individual insurance market. And then premium subsidies for plans that are purchased through the exchange. Both bills would provide subsidies for people who are buying coverage through the exchange, starting at 100% of poverty, up to 400% of poverty in the Senate bill. The Senate caps people's expenses on premiums as a share of their income, starting at 2% and rising to 9.8% at 400% of poverty, or about $88,000 for a family of four. In the House, the premium subsidies start at 133% of poverty, which is and rise to 400% of poverty, starting at capping premium expenditures at 1.5% of income and rising to 12% of income. In terms of what these look like in dollar amounts, the premium caps translate into total premiums of about $2,700, $2,400 for a family of four, who are earning about $44,000 a year, and about $6,500 for families earning about $66,000 a year. The provisions in both bills allow for indexing. So as premiums grow over time, whatever you are paying as a share of your income, that premium share will stay with you over time. So as premium costs grow, individuals and the federal government share in the cost of that premium growth. So this really does underscore the need for the system reforms in these bills and for other provisions that will lower the cost trajectory both for individuals and the federal government. This is a somewhat complicated slide. In addition to premium subsidies, both bills reduce cost sharing for people with low and moderate incomes. Premium subsidies are linked in both bills to plans with an actuarial value of 70%, meaning that the plans would on average cover about 70% of someone's costs, total medical costs, leaving policyholders with about 30% of costs on average for their medical bills. Under the Senate bill, cost-sharing subsidies and lower out-of-pocket maximums, both bills specify lower out-of-pocket maximums, and they're lowered for people in lower incomes. This has the effect of increasing the actuarial value of the plans to about 90% for families earning less than 150% of poverty, and about 80% for those earning between 150 and 200% of poverty. So we examined what this means for a standard population we know across the U.S. population that costs are concentrated among the top 50% of the distribution. So most healthcare costs occur among a relatively small number of people. Most people are relatively healthy. They account for not a lot of the costs overall. So when we take that distribution and apply it to the population that would be enrolled in these plans, making some assumptions about what deductibles and coinsurance would be, you can see on this slide the silver plan, which is the 70% actuarial value plan in the Senate bill, the potential out-of-pocket costs for people across the spending distribution, looking at sicker at the very top and down to the healthiest people at the very bottom of that distribution, and you can see how costs would decline with the cost-sharing subsidies across lower income households. Under the House bill, you can see that if you look at this, you may have to take this home and look at it a little more carefully. And I think Deanne's also going to address this, she has much simpler charts, which will help a lot. But the House bill has much more generous cost-sharing subsidies and caps out-of-pocket costs at a much lower level than the Senate. So consequently, people are much more protected against out-of-pocket costs. For example, if you look at the column 150% to 200% of poverty, the people who are the sickest would spend no more than $1,000, about 3% of their income, compared to nearly $2,000 or 6% of their income in the Senate bill. People whose costs are just above the median would spend about $700 in the House bill compared to about $1,900 in the Senate bill. People who are very healthy, have very few costs over the year, would spend about $75 in the House compared to about $240 in the Senate. Each bill requires that people have health insurance, and this is a really essential part of this approach to healthcare reform. We have fragmented risk, still will have risk pools that are separated, employer group, Medicaid, and this new insurance exchange. You have to have a mandate to keep all those together. There are some penalties for noncompliance. In the new Senate bill, the penalties start off at $95 per person in 2014, and they rise to $750 by 2016. The House bill will charge about 2.5% of the difference between people's modified adjusted gross incomes and their tax filing threshold. So this fee rises with income. You can see it on the chart what happens to that fee. So it starts at about $242 for a family between $20,000 and $30,000 and rises to about $2,500 for a family earning between $100,000 and $200,000, and it's capped at the average national premium. So for an individual, that's approximately $3,500. On your chart pack, I have the wrong exemption level for the Senate bill. We originally thought it was 9.8, and it's actually 8% as it was in the Senate finance bill. So the exemption from the mandate occurs if you can't find a premium that's less than 8% of your income. The small businesses benefit very well under the three bills. They're eligible, first of all, to buy health insurance for their employees through the health insurance exchange. They're exempt from the shared responsibility requirements in both bills. The House bill has a requirement to offer and contribute to your employees benefits, and the Senate bill has a penalty if you have an uninsured worker who gets a premium contribution or premium subsidy through the exchange. So small employers in both bills are exempt from those penalties. And they're also eligible for tax credits. They're very similar. Their tax credits are targeted to very small, low-wage firms, so the full credit is available to firms of 10 and falling, and with average wages of about 20,000. The credit phases out up to firms of 25 and average wages of about $40,000. The major difference between the two bills on this is the amount of premium contribution employers have to make in order to qualify for the credit. It's only 50% of the premium, the full premium in the Senate. It's 65% of the premium cost in the House. These are also time limited, so they're only available for a couple years. And I believe in the Senate bill they're available, and I'm not sure about the House, so to check, but I think they're available before the full the rest of the insurance reforms go into play. So I will stop there.
Very good. Thanks very much, Sarah. Let's turn to Stuart.
Thank you very much, Ed, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I just want to compliment Rachel and Sarah not only on their work here, but also their ability to keep up with changing circumstances. I got the first major revision, I think, the morning after the Reid bill was introduced. So it is true that people at Commonwealth never sleep, which is what I always thought. Also, it kind of reminds me of trying to work in this area in healthcare policy reform these days is a little bit like the problem of it is a little bit like Churchill said the problem was with studying history. The problem with studying history, he said, is they keep adding to it all the time. Of course, Churchill also said that history is really one damn thing after another. And those of you who are Republicans in the audience may feel that is also characteristic of healthcare reform. But anyway, when we look at the idea of the issue of affordability, it does have several dimensions. And what I'd like to do in my opening remarks is kind of broadly look at this idea of, or this issue of affordability in three dimensions or three ways, only one of which was looked at in the study. First of all, when you look at the idea of affordability, there's sort of there's both a numerator and a denominator. One may make changes that make something affordable to people in a more obvious sense of subsidies and so on that we've discussed. But if you do also things like taxes or regulations that apply in healthcare that have the effect of changing the compensation that people have, causing them to have lower cash income in the future because of other changes that are taking place, you may well erode the advantages you have with improving affordability at the front end, in other words, to dilute the subsidy. And I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. Second, affordability, as is pointed out in this study, is very case-specific, that when you look at any piece of legislation, it's important not only to look at the ranges of attempts at affordability as we see here, but also to just look at some of the more troubling or areas of affordability between different people that may cause some concerns in terms of looking at the legislation, and I'll mention those. And then finally, affordability can also apply to the country as a whole and from one generation to the next. When we do something in healthcare like other areas, we may well make changes that have effects on people right now. But if that has an implication over the long haul, both to people's costs over the long haul, but also any changes in our ability to fund other areas of our public policy work, that also has implications in terms of affordability. I just want to touch on each of these very quickly. The first, the idea that people's compensation as a whole is an important thing to take into mind, not just their affordability of health care. The fact is, if you look at these bills, there are a number of things, from explicit taxes on so-called Cadillac plans and so on, to mandates on employers to provide certain levels of coverage and therefore, as part of the compensation of their employees, influencing their decisions with regard to cash income, that is very likely, and will indeed, alter the pattern of cash compensation in the future, and therefore the general affordability that individuals have to look at healthcare and other issues. For example, the so-called Cadillac tax hits people who have those plans, even if they have moderate and lower income, if they're in companies that have very generous plans. And over time, because of the indexing feature of that particular provision, which is not going to be indexed as rapidly as health insurance itself would rise, you'll see more and more people who have modest and even low income finding that employers start to adjust their cash income over time. And that will affect their ability to afford not just health care, but other issues in the future. And I think it's very, very important to look at that. Indeed, this is a major item, in fact, over time in the Senate bill. Also, of course, so it's very, very important to look at that. It's not just the premium and affordability with regard to actual expenditures on healthcare. It is also an issue of what does this mean for your pattern of cash income in the future. If that is reduced, if the pace is reduced in the future, that has an effect on your affordability of health insurance and other things. The second point I wanted to kind of draw your attention to think about, is this issue of variations among households, how affordability will alter under these bills depending on your situation. As Rachel and Sarah focused on, the difference for people of different incomes is, of course, very critical and very central to all of this. And it's an issue that's been raised very widely in terms of looking at these two bills, in particular the way in which the House bill tends to focus more on people who are modest and lower income people and less on people who are higher income. And while the Senate bill, as has been pointed out, puts caps rather more generous caps, if you like, in the sense of more help for people 300 to 400% of poverty, and less help than the House bill to those at the lower end. And it's an issue that's been raised by groups like Families USA and others in terms of looking at the two bills. I think that's very, very important. I think it's also very important to recognize that there are big differences between people who are inside the exchange system, which is really what we've been focusing on up to now, and those people who remain in the employer-based system. There are big differences in terms of horizontal equity between people who are similarly placed with regard to income, but in the future may have coverage through the exchange compared with those who have coverage through the place of work. There's a differential at the highest amount of between $6,000 to $7,000 difference in terms of the subsidies that are available to people in those two situations. Now, it's true that people who are in the employment-based system do have the tax exclusion, but for people who are modest income, that's of very little value. It only really affects their payroll tax. So you do see very sharp differences between similarly situated people who are covered in different ways through the exchange system or through the employment-based system in these bills. That's very, very important. And all kinds of perverse implications can come from that, not only in terms of this obvious sort of horizontal inequity, but when you look for example, the free rider tax, the fact that if some employers provide coverage, and a number of their lower income eligible people decide instead to get coverage through the exchange system, then the employer, perhaps seeming reasonably, will be hit with a $3,000 tax as a so-called free rider, so they're not really sort of getting something for nothing by their employee leaving. That can have lots of implications in terms of hiring patterns. If you are essentially a middle income employer, in other words, most of your workforce is more middle income, and you only have a few low-income employees, you get hit with this tax Whereas if you've got a larger number of low-income people, it's a different and lower situation. That means that if you are an employer who has predominantly middle-class people, your openness to actually hiring people of modest income, low-income potential employees and household income, who might be people who would use less services, you're going to be discouraged from hiring those people. And that's something that's been pointed out in a number of, by a number of organizations. So when we look at this issue of affordability, we see these horizontal effects as being very important, and we really need to focus on and look at that a little bit further. And then the third area I will just mention is this issue of affordability over the long term, and also affordability to the nation as a whole. There was a lot of talk about bending the cost curve, it has indeed been bent under these bills, but bent up rather than bent down. And of course, as the cost goes up of healthcare relative to other parts of the economy, we will see pressures making it more difficult to afford other goals and other important things that we see in our society. I occasionally speak at conferences at the state level on education, and it's just like a constant refrain at the state level of people who deal with education saying the cost of Medicaid in our state is squeezing out the ability to have funds available for education. That is also true in a national level. The more that the total costs of healthcare go up, as they will do under these bills, the more that squeezes the affordability of other goals that we have in our society. And it's very, very important, I think, to bear that in mind. Let's also remember, when we look at this effect over time, that as the years go by, and particularly as we go beyond the first 10 years, which incidentally is really only the first 6 years of actual implementation of this legislation, because really nothing much happens for the first 3 or possibly even 4 years, depending on the bill, you see a bigger impact over time. The actual outlays, the actual spending in this legislation, if you look at the CBO's analysis of the Senate bill, for example, is about $1.2 trillion. There are clawbacks and so on associated with that, and some of those figures are netted out in the CBO analysis. But the actual expenditure is that over time. But that assumes a number of things, including things like the doctor fix basically disappearing after a couple of years, and so doctors start getting large reductions in their fees and so on. If that doesn't happen, then these costs go up very significantly. As I said, it only looks at the first 6 years. If you look at the first full 10 years of implementation, sort of 2014 to 2023, you see a total cost of more like $2.5 trillion of actual costs that have got to be financed in some way. So this is a major level of spending that is going to affect the affordability of other things that we want in our society. And as if one also looks at not just the spending level, but the implications for future generations, if this spending is not fully covered in terms of unfunded obligations, that means that money available for future generations to deal with their own personal costs as well as the cost of the nation, if we don't see the savings that are being suggested in these pieces of legislation, that also adds to that implication in terms of costs and therefore affordability for people in the future. And certainly the Congressional Budget Office, and very recently, last week, the actuaries of the Department of Health and Human Service, Rick Foster, the chief actuary there, have been very skeptical about whether we will in fact see the offsets to reduce the net effect on future deficits. The Medicare Advantage plans, for example, the reductions that are proposed there, that Rick Foster points out that this would have to mean a reduction in enrollment of, he says, for up to 64% of people. You have to ask yourself, is this likely to happen in the future? We also, in the Senate bill, the assumption is that we will see reductions in doctor fees after the first year of 20% and then held after that. It's never happened before, and it's very unlikely, in my mind, that it will happen in the future. I think it's delusional to think this is going to happen. And if it doesn't, we are going to see high costs spread on into the future. The CBO also says that a lot of the major savings are dependent upon the Independent Medicare Advisory Board, the so-called supercharged MedPAC, actually being able to achieve reductions in Medicare over time. I would only just remind you of the kind of outrage that followed a federal task force on mammograms merely advising that perhaps there should be a reduction for, or elimination of this for women aged 30 to 40. Just an advisory on that led HHS Secretary Sebelius to say, oh, no way is this going to happen in any program. So you've got to imagine, despite this, that somehow major radical changes are going to occur in the future to keep the costs under control. I could go on. There are a number of these. But the bottom line is, when you look at affordability over time, there are a lot of assumptions that are based in these bills of things that really anybody who's been around for a while, not even as long as I have looking at these things, are going to be very skeptical that they're actually going to happen. That has big implications for affordability for people in the future. So in conclusion, when you look at this issue, and I just want to emphasize this, all of us on this panel and all of us really engaged in this debate want to achieve the goals of reform. It is an outrage that in this country we have millions of people who are uninsured and face these kinds of costs and go bankrupt and so on. There's no argument about that. But when we look at correcting this issue and looking at trying to bring affordability down for people, it is important, in my view, to look at it in at least these dimensions that I've mentioned, not only the specific day-to-day sort of impact, the most obvious impact that you could get from these bills. And right now, it seems to me that we've got to look a lot harder at this legislation to be comfortable about those wider aspects of affordability. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart. Let's turn now to Deanne Friedholm from Consumers Union. Can I get the clicker?
Good afternoon. I am not an economist. I'm a practitioner. I've run big public programs. I've advocated for individuals, worked in the legislative process. And so the perspective I'd like to bring to this is slightly different than the previous two speakers. And that is stopping and just stepping back from all of the facts and figures and numbers and very important points that Dr. Butler and Sarah have made, and just say, how are people going to fare if anything close to what we are being, what is being talked about in the House and Senate actually becomes law. And I want to do that in part by talking about some of the families and individuals that we have worked with over the past year. CU started a major initiative on health reform a couple of years ago. We have collected tens of thousands of stories from people around the country. We took a bus out around to collect stories and meet people. We have an activist network of people in all 50 states. We've done analysis. We do polling frequently. And we've written a number of articles, I think six or seven articles now in Consumer Reports magazine about the issues and problems that consumers are facing. So one of the let's see if I can do this from here. Yes, it was. One of the things that we find, and it's important to keep in mind in all of this, is that Americans have very kind of schizophrenic thoughts about health reform and where they stand in it. We heard this summer frequently quoted different polls that say Americans in the 80 percentiles, they varied a little bit, but close to 4 out of 5 Americans who had insurance, either public or private, were satisfied with their coverage. And some people wanted to use that as an example of why we didn't need to do comprehensive reform. But in our polling, those very same type of people, by similar numbers, at 3 out of 4, 75%, showed enormous concern about their situation. So even though they might say that they're satisfied, they're also they have grave concerns and fears for loss of job that would end up with the loss of their insurance, having some kind of major medical problem that ended up financially ruining their family, being denied coverage if they were to lose their insurance through their work, on and on. Those kinds of things that seem to be saying kind of two different things to us. So I hesitate to sit here as a representative of consumers and pretend that there's any one consumer view. There isn't. I just want to kind of walk us through some of the elements of reform and how it might affect. you know the problems that people face in the system. We don't need to spend time. One area that we have heard a lot about and that was not as prevalently understood before is that a lot of people, and these are a huge proportion of the stories that we've been told, are individuals who have health insurance and thought they had good coverage until they found out that they didn't, until they had a major medical problem, illness, cancer, accident, and they had to actually use their coverage for significant health care. And the numbers that are estimated, Commonwealth had a poll, our poll was similar, was somewhere around 25 million people in this country, if you looked at what their coverage today, would be considered to be underinsured. They count as among those numbers that say they're insured, but when they really had to use it, it would not cover substantial parts of their costs. The problem is they find that out too late. And I want to talk through two or three stories here. The first is Janice and Gary Clausen. They were, you know, in their early 1960s. She lost her job as an accountant. They therefore lost their insurance. They went shopping on the market. They're well-educated people. They're knowledgeable. They shopped around. They picked a $500 a month policy. They knew that the limitation on this policy was $50,000 a year. But they had no idea how expensive health care was that they would be having to use. He got colon cancer. Their costs ended up costing over $200,000, and their cost to them, even though they had insurance, was $150,000. And as they said to us, they expect that they will spend the rest of their life trying to pay off these medical debts. Another example is a young woman, Catherine Howard. This is kind of going to be a tale of two women who got breast cancer. Catherine Howard, a San Francisco freelance film producer, 29 years old. She couldn't afford a really comprehensive plan, so she shopped around and bought one of those great, you know, high deductible, low premium plans with a $2,500 deductible and 30% copay. But she didn't expect to get sick. She thought she might, you know, break her leg snowboarding or something. But she, you know, she's 29. She's healthy. What's the problem? Well, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And what she found out, in that process, was that while it covered things like hospitalization, it didn't cover chemotherapy. It didn't cover outpatient services. And she tells the story of watching one of the chemo drugs going into her vein, knowing that it cost her $600 every single time, and she had those drugs daily, you know, for a number of months. Today, she's paying off her debts $1,800 a month. Out of her paycheck to try to pay off her own debts of over $40,000. And the contrast, which I think brings into focus the kinds of changes that we're trying to talk about, is another young woman who lives in Massachusetts. She was a waitress in her family's restaurant, 27 years old, no health care. And then Massachusetts passed its reforms. She was required to get insurance. She went, and based on her income, which was quite low, she was eligible for Commonwealth care. And after she got Commonwealth care, she went in to have an annual physical, and they found breast cancer, 27 years old. And she was able to be treated with very little out-of-pocket cost for herself, in contrast to Catherine's situation. And she has told us if she had not had an insurance, she would have never made that appointment. They would have never turned up her cancer until it was much too late, and she probably would not be alive today. So differences of experience in the way that the system is treating people. I guess one of the first things we have to say is that affordability, and I think Stuart mentioned this or touched upon it as well, affordability really depends on what your circumstances are, and it's all about compared to what. If you're a person who is uninsured right now, facing any of these premium amounts up to 12% of your income or 9.8% of your income in the Senate bill, at a 400% of poverty. So if you're uninsured, that's going to be a sudden major hit on your family's budget that you're not used to. We've had people in our network of people who are hanging on waiting for health reform because they don't have coverage, they can't get it, and then when they hear that they would be likely to be required to spend 10 to 12%, they find that to be a huge change, a huge hit on what their family's income is. On the other hand, if you're uninsured, and you have any kind of illness and you're not being able to get coverage, like many people that we've worked with, the idea of 12% is golden. They've been being quoted $2,400 a month, $3,600 a month to get coverage. And so, you know, this kind of, any of the kinds of plans, be it the House or the Senate, look very good to them. The other thing is that people's circumstances are very different. As Dr. Butler said, you can have two families, same family size, same makeup, same income levels. One of them has grandparents who are going to pay for their kids to go to college, and the others don't. They have to try to save for it. So every single situation is going to, every single family will view these things and whether they are affordable or not from their own perspectives. All of that being said, there are a lot of really important changes in the bills that Sarah pointed out. I'm not going to go through those, but when we think about what is affordable, we, at least at CU, when we're looking at these, what is it that we're really looking for? You're looking for insurance that is secure, that is available, always there for you, and somewhat predictable, especially if you have a major life healthcare problem. And the legislation that's being talked about goes a very long way. House or Senate bill goes a long way towards addressing some of the biggest concerns that consumers have expressed to us and financial problems. You will always be able to buy something. If you lose your job, you'll be able to go into the exchange. The ending of lifetime and annual maximum benefits, which really hurts families who find themselves battling high-cost problems. The different ranges, the different levels of benefit packages in the exchange, for example, that lets you make your choices about the trade-off between how much premium you want to pay versus how much out-of-pocket exposure you would want to have. A comprehensive kind of essential set of benefit package. This is very important. It helps consumers make better choices and have available better choices. And then all kinds of other consumer protections, the, you know, ending of rescissions. All of these are very important, and they are part, in our estimate, of affordability, an important part of insurance, which is to help you handle a major expense that you otherwise would not be able to. We do have concerns, and as I've said before, that in the various bills, depending on what your income level is, you know, you may have a stretch at being able to afford the premium. The House bill is better for people who are in that 100 to 200% of poverty range. It's a lower maximum for your premiums. And the Senate bill, on the upper end of the subsidy level, the Senate has a lower amount. But basically, you know, the ranges that the House and the Senate are talking about are well in the range for lots of people and much better than what they have today. It's all comparative. Many will still face high out-of-pocket costs. And one of the things that I want to kind of focus on and wrap up with is how important it is that as we move to a new system such as being envisioned, that we make sure that consumers are given the kinds of information they need to avoid the problems that we just saw that Catherine had and the other couple had when they were trying to make a good choice of insurance. And one of the issues that that we are a little bit concerned about is the use of the actuarial value as one of the ways to compare and contrast the different levels of plans in the healthcare exchange. And this is a simplified version of the chart that that Sarah had. But basically, what we want to point out is that people may think that the actuarial value means that, for example, with the silver, that 70% of their costs are going to be covered. But this is based on averages. So if you are a healthy young person and you don't use a lot of health care, throughout that year, you're going to be paying 100% of your health care until you get up to that maximum. So you really haven't had 70% coverage of all your health care. Whereas if you're a high user, if you encounter a medical problem or have a high expense, you will end up being better off. So it's important for people to understand, for consumers to have these kinds of terms explained to us. We have a paper that was available out on the table if you want to understand more of that. Final point is, and I really appreciate a lot of the points that Dr. Butler made, but all of this affordability, premium subsidies, what your total out-of-pocket or your total costs are going to be in a year, are in trouble if we don't really get control of the overall healthcare costs as the years go by. And it won't be affordable if they continue to rise faster than our incomes. We need to have good information for consumers to be able to compare plans based really on apples-to-apples competition. Some of the thought is that the reason prices have continued to rise so much is there's not a lot of real competition in the insurance industry. But we're going to have to really have comparative information between plans if you're going to avoid the kinds of problems we have today with insurance companies designing plans to cherry-pick for the healthier and avoid the sicker population. We do believe a public option, a robust one, would help in to improve the competition in the system. And we have pressed very hard to make sure that we have common definitions of terms. We don't want a hospitalization to mean after your first day in the hospital, which is one of the stories we had. They thought they had hospital coverage. They did, but it started after the first day, which is almost always the most expensive. We should have one standard plan in each of those levels in order to eat the bronze, the silver, the gold, the platinum, so that every insurance company, at least on one plan, has to have exactly the same thing so you can compare them face to face. And we need to let people be able to get estimates of what their costs will be. The Plan D program in Medicare, you can go online and you can do estimates of what your costs are based on your utilization. That kind of thing really needs to be available. I will stop with that, except to say that we do believe that the costs, overall system costs, have to be brought down, and that can't be done just by trying to control costs in Medicare or Medicaid. It really needs to be in the private sector and across board. And that's the nugget that I think is the most difficult for us to solve in terms of affordability. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you so much, Deanne. We are now at the point where you get a chance to enter into the conversation. As I mentioned, there are some microphones in the front of the room. You can come to. There are also green cards that you can hold up, and someone on the staff will bring it up forward, and we'll try to get some answers from our panelists. Sarah, while we're waiting for that process, I wonder if you could say a few more words about the slide that is entitled Percent of Income Spent on Premiums from your presentation. How is it if there are caps on the percent of income that you are going to be required to spend, that those caps seem to be exceeded in the years after the initial ones?
So this is a great point, and certainly was illuminating to me too. The way the bills are defined, and I believe the Senate finance was definitely structured this way, and I believe the same is in the Senate bill, but I'm not entirely sure. I know the House bill has this indexing provision. But essentially, if you receive a premium cap, say at 6% of your income, if you're at that income level, and then in the following year the premiums rise, the share of the premium that you paid under that cap would stay the same, which means that if your premium grew, the amount as a share of your income would also grow. So the idea is that the federal government share would stay the same and the individual enrollees would stay the same. So it really does underscore this need to keep premium costs down.
Very good, thank you. So what they guarantee is that you won't pay any higher percentage of the premium,
right,
which may amount to a higher percentage of your income over time. I see. Okay. Yes, would you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. Chris Jacobs with the House Republican Conference. We've heard a lot of the discussion today talking about the underinsured in the private health insurance market, and I'm curious how many people are underinsured in government-run health insurance, either because Medicare does not have a catastrophic cap on expenses, And so you have to keep paying and paying and paying, or you go out to AARP and buy a Medigap policy for that. In the cases where many state Medicaid programs, you just can't get access and you have to wait for a month or longer, something like that. We saw that Diamante driver in Prince George's County, tragically, a couple of years ago. I know the fund has put out numbers on the underinsured in private health insurance on several occasions. If the fund and others think that government-run health insurance, that this should be an option for everybody, then why don't we have a study saying how many people are underinsured in government-run health care and how low that is compared to private health care?
Sarah, you want to take a crack at that?
Thank you for your question. It's a great question. When we did the analysis of the underinsured, we looked at the under 65 population, and we did look at the difference between employer and individual. I think the Medicare certainly has issues in terms of what people's out-of-pocket exposure is, and John Gable has done some analysis looking at Medicare Parts A and B, and then as you add in the supplements, you increase the actuarial value of those plans. So it really is important in the Medicare program to have these supplements to reduce your out-of-pocket costs. There's no question about it. So I think when we think about offering plans through the exchange, that the public plan would look like the private plans that would be offered through the exchange, so that they would be subject to the same benefit standards, have the same cost-sharing tiers, same premium subsidies and cost-sharing subsidies. So those would apply in the bills to both the private and public plans that would be offered through the health insurance exchange.
Anybody else? Deanne?
With regard to Medicaid, I think you're making a really good point. Medicaid is probably the richest benefit package of any plan anywhere, maybe in the world.
You can find somebody who's willing to take.
But the problem is that the reimbursements in most places are significantly lower than even Medicare, and Medicare usually is lower than private. So it is an issue. The House version of reform includes funding to try to assist states, because states set that policy, not the federal government. It's the main thing that the states have complete control over in Medicaid. And the Senate bill, I don't think, well, I can't speak about the most recent version, but before they did not have, yeah. So it is a huge problem. When I ran Medicaid, I used to say that a Medicaid card was a hunting license. You know, it gave you a chance to go try to find a doctor. Some states are better than others, but it's a good point.
Deanne, you're up again. The questioner observes that you presented three cancer cases. Two cost about $150,000 in Iowa and California, but the case in Massachusetts cost $200,000. Aren't we assuming that wider coverage will reduce, this is a spread of costs, but reduce the overall costs, I think is what we're trying to get at, by reducing uncompensated care? And is that happening in Massachusetts? Have studies been done? If costs are rising in Massachusetts, are the providers gaming the system?
I don't hold myself out as an expert on the Massachusetts program in terms of any kind of studies that have been done. In Jacqueline's case, it was literally within about a month or two after the program had started and she had gotten coverage. So any positive effects of getting rid of or reducing uncompensated care, helping the costs for people with coverage, would not have kicked in by then. And we all know that some states are more expensive than others, as it is right now. The number of states, I think Massachusetts is one of the more expensive overall health care cost states. You really can't compare between states, even for similar types of medical problems. The point that I was making with those stories is just the impact on the individual and how they would perceive that insurance being adequate or affordable.
Stuart, you've done a lot of work in Massachusetts.
I just might comment on that, too, because I think Massachusetts, as some other cases also indicate, that in order to get coverage, wider coverage and affordable coverage, part of the presumption in much of this debate is that you will see a shift in the way people get health care, in particular, and this is emphasized in Massachusetts and also, of course, by Commonwealth, among others, to say we've got to move health care more towards the family practitioner, you know, the first responder, so to speak, in the healthcare system more. And we've got to kind of end, we've got to be able to bring about that shift in order to get a lot of these savings. And that presumes that you can do this. Massachusetts, first of all, underscores the problem that if you don't have in existence right now a large number of primary physicians and so on relative to specialists, that in itself is causing a problem in Massachusetts and may well mean that the cost, the actual price you have to pay in terms of salaries and so on to get an adequate supply of them moves up. It also means that over time you do actually want to see a shifting of resources away from certain parts of the healthcare industry to another part. Now, Peter Orszag is very good at getting up and saying, you know, assume this happens and you get all these savings. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't seem to happen that easily. You seem to see all kinds of efforts on Capitol Hill and in state houses and so on to make sure that you don't see switching in this way from one part, from one sector, or from one specialty group to another. And I think the more that is a factor in the future, the more we actually see it difficult to do this, the more it's going to be difficult to achieve this objective of not only affordability for individuals in terms of the prices they pay, but affordability for the country as a whole in achieving this, because the actual price somebody pays directly for a service or for insurance, as in these cases, is sort of in many ways, you know, just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what the actual cost is for the society as a whole, and therefore the effects elsewhere. So I think Massachusetts underscores, as well as the kind of debates that we see here in Washington, it underscores the difficulty of getting the structural changes in the healthcare system so that we can actually meet these targets of affordability for individuals at a reasonable cost to the society as a whole.
Rachel, you want to add
I just want to add one thing on Massachusetts. I think I would certainly agree with Stuart's assertion that primary care system has been grossly undervalued and under-reimbursed for a long time. And we sponsored several evaluations of Massachusetts, and what we saw is even after the first year of reform, people, especially low-income individuals, although the system was not really prepared for thousands and thousands of new folks to be insured and moving into the healthcare system, they did have an easier time accessing providers before than they did before reform. And each year that gets easier and easier for people to do. They've got, you know, 97% of their populations insured. And it has taken some time to get the infrastructure built up. Both bills start us down the road of paying primary care differently. I think that it's a down payment. We need to do a lot more. But they are a step in the right direction towards getting our incentives aligned for the primary care services and the more integrated services that we think could offer more value.
And let me just add a small commercial. There is on our website a bunch of materials related to a briefing we did several months ago that in part focused on the access questions in Massachusetts. And I know Sharon Long from the Urban Institute has done a lot of work that is chronicled in that briefing, and she spoke at that briefing, and I would urge you to take a look at some of that information. Yes, would you?
Hi, my name is Jessica Banthan. I'm from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And I have a question for Stuart that's a little technical but leads into a broader question that I think all of the panelists might want to comment on. Before I ask the question, just as a follow-up of the earlier question from the young man over there, we have a paper under review at Health Affairs and we've already presented some preliminary results that look at Medicaid families with high out-of-pocket burdens. And the preliminary results that we've presented at the ARC annual conference show that most of those expenses come from drugs, and that the access problems are particularly acute in buying prescription drugs among Medicaid families, and that sometimes the formulary rules possibly aren't being implemented correctly. They're denied the drug or have to go back and get prior approval or something like that, and instead decide to purchase the whole thing out of pocket and pay the full price. And we've done that analysis with the medical expenditure panel survey. So, Stuart, I have a question concerning overall compensation, which I think is very important. If we adjust in the employer group market, if we do implement things like taxes and so forth that eventually affect worker compensation, how do we know how employers will reduce or adjust compensation according to general, let's just say, age groups or health status groups? They're not allowed to charge premiums differentially for health or age groups at the moment, but we know that most of the young people here in this room who have health insurance through their employer do not actually cost their employer that much, the federal government. And yet the older ones of us actually cost, and who have family policies, cost quite a bit. So if in the extreme case a large group employer stopped offering health insurance, they would adjust people's compensation upwards. But in what ways? They might adjust older workers' compensation not at all and younger workers' compensation up considerably more. And I'm not sure we know how to anticipate how they would do that. And that leads into my final broader question is, do we have affordability standards that matter by age group? Is that an issue, especially in this environment of a mandate?
You're absolutely correct, of course, and there isn't a simple answer because it depends on the situation. I mean, obviously, in say, for example, large self-insured or unionized firms, this would be negotiated. I mean, if you have any form of tax, if there's a Cadillac plan tax or something like that, how that shows up in terms of compensation changes will depend on the bargaining that goes on in that particular firm. So I don't think there is an answer. I think underscores the point that the effect on individuals will depend on where they are, what their situation is, and so on. Your general point, of course, is absolutely correct, that in general, we're clearly seeing a difference in cost to the employer of any mandate or anything like that, depending on the age range in general. It's not the only factor, of course, but the age ranges of their employees. And that's kind of one of the reasons I mentioned this issue of the so-called free rider tax. Because I would imagine that if you've got a firm that has predominantly middle-income people and therefore would face that tax for low-income individuals, that is going also tend to make that employer be more hesitant to hire a younger person. I mean, if you don't have that tax and the person is insured by the employer and it's an 18-year-old, the marginal additional cost of bringing that person on and insuring them is going to be relatively low. If that person comes on and because of their income decides to go into the exchange, you get hit with in all probability, a much higher cost than you would have paid had they stayed with you. So the very fact that somebody in these cases can move to the exchange will in fact discourage you from hiring that class of person. But it's a complex issue, and I don't want to suggest otherwise at all. And it is hard to do this. I think the best we can do is sort of give, you know, kind of draw some notional conclusions, some generalities about how this might impact people.
Can I just ask somebody on the panel, whether Stuart, you or Sarah or somebody, to explain in relatively simple terms exactly how the free rider penalties work? Because triggering the large penalty is sort of right. Counterintuitive.
Let me try to answer and then be corrected by the others, I suspect, because I can't remember the exact details of this. But basically the issue is, let's say you're an employer and you're providing coverage or something like that, and then there are certain categories of people, low-income people in general, I forget the exact numbers and you can maybe tell me this, below a certain level that could decide instead to say, I want to go into the exchange and get the subsidies associated with that. So the issue is, well, why should an employer get a, quote, free ride from some, you know, they have somebody, but that person goes and gets subsidized somewhere else, and they don't have to pay for it. So a tax is looked at. There are two classes of, two levels of tax, as I understand it. One is to say, if you've got predominantly low-income people, so it's a big issue, if you like, you pay a relatively low, I think it's $750, whatever it is, the per person tax. On the other hand, if you are predominantly employing middle-income people and only have a few low-income people, then it's a much higher tax, $3,000. And therefore, you've got all kinds, if you're in the hiring business, you're profiling, right? You're going to be looking at people and thinking about now, what's going to happen if this person comes and then goes into the exchange? So that's why this issue arises. I don't know how large of an issue it's going to be, although for, you know, for big firms, that's a significant factor. But, you know, maybe you can correct me if my numbers are wrong on that. But that's the issue I was getting at.
I think that is right. One important piece of this, though, if you are working as a low-wage worker or anyone in a firm that offers you coverage, and that coverage doesn't exceed, your contribution doesn't exceed 9.8% of your income, then you're not eligible for a premium subsidy through the exchange. So there is a firewall between the exchange and employers. On the other hand, if your contribution is really high, then you go into the exchange, then your employer is subject to a tax.
If I may add, though, but one of the issues here is whether that firewall can hold over time. Because clearly, if it may well be that you're not eligible to go into this because of that percentage. But if you look over there, and the guy over there in the exchange, the guy who works for the firm next to you, is getting a large subsidy in the exchange, you know, a $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 subsidy, and you're not, because you work for Dunkin' Donuts or something like this, and these are the exact cases that are being looked at, there's enormous pressure in round two of reform to say, get rid of this firewall. Because, and if you don't get rid of the firewall, it's heavily inequitable between two equivalent people facing the same medical situation, the same basic income. One can get in the exchange and one can't, and there's a huge difference in the subsidy and therefore affordability level that they face.
Just to look at what CBO, how they're looking at this issue, I mean, when they look at 2019, they're seeing a very minimal decline in employer-based coverage. So only in the Senate bill, only dropping by about 5 million people. In the House bill, actually increasing. The employer mandate has a big effect on this, so it actually increases coverage of people in employer-based plans. So the employer-based coverage will remain the, at least since under the CBO scenarios, the primary source of coverage for most people. I think in terms of overall financing too, you can see really the big what it means to have employers in the system. The CBO estimates between the House and the Senate, it's a much bigger offset from employers in the House bill in terms of revenues than in the Senate bill because of the mandate. So it's important from an overall financing perspective to keep employers in the system. Most employers offer coverage now, especially large employers, and CBO is obviously expecting that is likely going to continue. On the age rating issue, the report that we have coming out in the next few days, we actually do. I think this is an important issue. So the age rating in the Senate bill is now at 3 to 1. It was at 4 to 1 in the finance bill, the House bill.
Can I just ask you what does that mean? 3 to 1, 5 to 1, 2 to 1.
So an age band means that as an older person, your premium cannot be more than three times what it is a younger person's premium.
So I like that.
So right now in the individual market, you could be charged a lot more if you're older than you can if you're younger. It's a good deal for younger people, but not so great for older people. But the way that works out, just in terms of numbers, someone who's age 60, and this is the basic plan or the silver plan in the Senate bill, and this is someone who's not eligible for a premium subsidy, so his income is at 500% of poverty or whatnot, is about $7,900 for someone who's 60, compared to about $2,600 for someone who's 20. So there is, you know, still a large difference between the two. In the House, the difference is 2-to-1, so the way it works out in dollars, someone who's age 60, not eligible for a subsidy, is at about $6,300 premium. Someone who's age 20 is half that, right? So about $3,100. So it is an important issue. And the subsidies work to offset that. So as you, the subsidies will help people who are older by offsetting that rating issue. But for people who are outside the subsidies, it is an issue.
Well, maybe come back to that because we've gotten a couple of questions about it specifically on some cards, but you've been very patient standing at the microphone.
David Rabin, Georgetown Medical School. A critical issue with health insurance has been the rapid rise in the underinsured. It's particularly critical for chronically ill people who are the big expenditure people. They are much more like the uninsured in the way they use services as compared to the insured. They don't use their drugs, they don't get follow-up tests, they don't go for initial examinations, and they end up with higher complications and avoidable illness. I know no one knows, but I wonder, particularly from the Commonwealth people who have helped focus on this issue, what is your sense of the issue of the healthcare reform as currently conceived on over time, the proportion of people who will be underinsured, particularly those that are chronically ill and have high medical expenditures?
The slide that I showed earlier gives a complicated kind of analysis of these cost-sharing subsidies. So importantly, even without the subsidies, the minimum benefit standards are a huge issue in terms of protecting people, knowing what you're getting, and then having each bill also places out-of-pocket maximums for people who are just buying that plan without a premium subsidy. They're slightly lower in the House for the full population. The House bill has more generous protection from out-of-pocket costs than the Senate bill does. And you can particularly, it particularly occurs in this 150%, 200%, 250% of poverty range, where people in the House covered under the House bill would be much better protected than under the Senate bill. What both of the bills technically do, what they mean by cost-sharing credits, is that they raise the actuarial value of their basic plan for people in lower income ranges. The House bill raises that up much higher to almost 90%, 97% for people in very low-income households above the Medicaid eligibility level, and then drops it down at a much slower rate. So as you go out up the income scale, you're paying somewhat more of the out-of-pocket costs, but it's less than you do in the Senate bill. Both the out-of-pocket maximums really do protect people who have high expenditures. And just to give you an example, people with in the very top 1% of the spending distribution under these plans maybe have an expected cost of $90,000. So someone who gets really sick. So that if you didn't have health insurance coverage, that would be your cost. Under the even without the premium subsidy, under the basic plan in the House bill, you would be capped at $5,000. In the Senate bill, you'd be capped at about just over $5,000. If you're earning about $44,000 under the House bill, you'd be capped at about $1,000. So it is, for people who have very high expenditures, this is a significant improvement over what a plan that they would likely purchase in the individual market. So there is a significant attempt in both those bills to address the underinsured issue.
Let me come back now to this age rating question. As I understand it, the Senate bill has a range of 2-to-1, 3-to-1. and the House 5-1?
2-1.
2-1. Okay, I had it exactly right. The 5-1 actually appears in the question because the questioner writes that 5-1 is what the Academy of Actuaries has previously said is about actuarially fair. And I wonder, two things. One is we're hoping to do a briefing on this in January, so we're very happy that you have a report coming out. But also, didn't Massachusetts have a sort of ameliorating, available only to very young people, bare bones policy that was supposed to take some of the pressure off the age differential? And is that working? Or is there a parallel in any of the legislation that we're kicking around?
Oh, I don't know if it's working. I can respond another way, but about that. But I mean, I think the general issue you're raising is a very important one. You know, you look at something like the federal employee system; it's a 1-1. I mean, you're basically getting the same premiums, and one of the impacts of this is the more you narrow that, the more, for example, somebody who is younger, looking at the penalty compared with how much they might pay themselves out of pocket if they weren't insured or had bare bones insurance, or just paid a fine, you know, by not having insurance. The more they're inclined to drop out of coverage, the wider. I mean, if you have say 4-1 or 3-1, fewer of those people will drop out. So you've got this sort of. It, like all these things, there's so many moving parts in this thing. You do one thing and it has another effect over here. That the more you narrow that, it's great for the people at the top end, I mean the older people, but the more you narrow that, the more people who are younger resist and don't see in their economic interest to be insured. They're more likely to say, let me just pay a fine. And then if they're this younger person that you mentioned who has paid a fine and isn't insured and gets breast cancer, they're even worse off than they are now, in a sense, because they're being fined for being, you know, not having coverage. So you've got a lot of these things to kind of look at when you look at different people in otherwise equal situations. And we just got to, you know, as we're doing here in this panel, you know, focus on this and realize this and realize that when we talk about this legislation to people generally, we mustn't imply it's sort of like a homogenous effect on everybody's going to be basically the same. In terms of these numbers, it's going to make big differences. And we've got to be really aware of that and think about what we're going to do when these differences show up and people start systematically acting, if their behavior patterns change in a clear pattern as a result of it, such as younger people saying, I'll just pay the fine because this banding just doesn't make any sense at all for me to get insurance.
Just add one comment to that. In the bills, and this is true in Massachusetts as well, in terms of young adults, the young adults benefit in three different ways. The expansion of the Medicaid eligibility first, up to 133 and 150. Most young adults who are uninsured are under 200% of poverty, so that will be a big improvement for young adults, and a lot of them will end up covered through the Medicaid program. Being able to stay on your parents' plan. Both bills now have that provision, and I believe it starts right away in both bills. And then this ability to buy through the exchange where the age rating issue comes into play.
Thank you. Yes, go right ahead.
Anna Summers, University of Maryland. I just have a clarifying question and probably a follow-up question regarding the penalty that employers would pay. So if we just go back to that example that Stuart Butler had of the mid-size firm with very few low-wage workers who would be subject to a penalty if the low-wage worker did not pick up the insurance and wanted to go into the exchange. The penalty you referred to, which some of the panelists have been saying 750, and then you mentioned maybe perhaps it would be as high as 3,000. First of all, is that an annual penalty or a monthly penalty?
It's annual.
Okay. I think it would be helpful in the literature to clarify that over and over again, because I think that makes a big difference. So for a mid-sized firm facing this penalty of $750 annually, that's less than $75 monthly. So if they're offering employer-sponsored insurance already and most of their workers are picking it up, they're probably already paying for those other workers a share of the premium on behalf of those workers that's probably higher than $75 a month. And so they aren't paying it for that low-wage worker who's not picking it up. So you had said that this $750 penalty could have a big impact on hiring practices.
Let me just correct that. I didn't say that. No, I said when there's a relatively small number of low-paid people, and therefore the second level of penalty kicks in, that's where I see the big impact, not on firms that predominantly hire low-income people. See what I'm saying?
Okay, what's the second level of penalty?
The second level is when you have a firm that only has a small number, I forget the exact percentage, but a relatively small number of low-income employees. That faces a higher penalty if any of those employees move out. Or
the $3,000 you mentioned?
Yes.
And I think it's also, I think it's related to the national premium, so the average national premium. And I think if you have a lot of workers, the idea was not to overburden a firm.
Yeah.
So the smaller number of workers, that fee might be less than it would be if it was spread over the full range of your.
Right. And I was just using these cases to underscore the fact that, you know, your actual situation, who you happen to work for, or where you try to get a job, or whether you're in an exchange or at an exchange, the same family ends up in a very different situation in terms of probability of being hired in the cases that I just mentioned, or what you actually will pay. That's just important to kind of recognize. It's not a nice, seamless sort of picture here. It's affected enormously by just situations you're in with regard to employment or whether you're eligible for the exchange.
So my final comment here is then it seems that also the thing that affects this is whether the business is offering employer-sponsored insurance and what premium they're already paying for those workers, because we talk about this cost to the employer as $750 or $3,000, but really there's a marginal cost.
No, you're absolutely correct, and it's the marginal cost that's important. So, for example, let's say you are thinking of a predominantly middle-income firm, and you're thinking of hiring somebody who's a low-paid person. If that person, for example, is very young, then you would think, okay, if I hire this person and cover them, it's not going to cost me a lot, really, because they're probably not going to, particularly if you're a self-insured firm, you know, it's not really going to cost me very much. On the other hand, if that person you hire, and then they say, well, when I look at it, it's still, but I'd rather be in the exchange. You get hit with a $3,000 cost. So it is, at the margin, you're discouraged from hiring somebody like that. It's just important to kind of understand that, as opposed to, say, an older, more experienced worker who you might be considering. Well, you might say, yeah, it is actually worth sort of paying. This is the kind of, I don't want to kind of overthink this, but I mean, you know, it's those kinds of cases where you'll see actual decisions significantly influenced by the design of this legislation.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Angela Vanderhoof, and I'm with the PICO National Network. And I have a question about the hardship waiver. So I heard you say it was at 8%, but there are families in the exchange that are getting subsidies up to 9.8. And so I'm wondering, are there families in the exchange that can take that hardship waiver, in a sense, aren't getting health insurance?
That's right. So there is the premium subsidies are capped at 300% and 400% of poverty, up between 300% and 400% at 9.8% of someone's income. However, you are actually exempt from the mandate if your premium expense is more than 8% of your income. So there is a recognition that they've come up this far on the premium subsidies, but this might not actually still be affordable to Deanne's point for a family who's looking at doing this. So they've lowered that exemption to 8%. The House bill doesn't have. They have some unspecified language about a financial hardship exemption, but they don't specify what it is.
So the people in that window would have a choice about whether to take the subsidy and get the coverage or simply go without.
Right. And the other provision, the Senate Bill 2, and this is to the SCMPI policy, or what they're calling a young adults policy in the Senate bill, which is like what they have in Massachusetts, would also be available for people who take the exemption. So, and they can buy a catastrophic plan.
Okay. We have a few more minutes, and I just want to give you a chance to pull your blue evaluation forms out and start filling them out as we finish these last few questions. And this one refers to insurance companies in rural areas. In those rural areas where one or two dominant insurers exist, are employers and individuals expected to leave their employer-based coverage for the exchange or public plan? And in such an environment, will the public plan have a substantial competitive effect given the likelihood that there may be one hospital serving the market? Speculation from our economists?
Well, as an economist, you say all other things being equal, you would anticipate that if there's only one or two insurers and so on, that people would tend to go into a public plan if it's available, if it becomes a law. On the other hand, as economists would say, the CBO points out that in the Senate legislation, that because in the new Senate legislation it's a negotiated premium in this public plan, they predict that the premium will be slightly higher in general, partly because of selection issues in terms of sicker people choosing those plans, and also because the public plan is not expected to have the kind of utilization controls that are common in private plans. And therefore, in that situation, an individual may not, assuming there's a public plan, a person may not, in fact, see a particular advantage of being in that public plan, which, of course, causes some people to say, well, why have it? But let me put that aside for now. But so it's not, you know, like most things, economists can give you five answers. Thank you.
I think this is a really important point, and it applies not only to rural areas, but applies to urban areas as well. We know that insurance markets are really concentrated. We know provider markets are really concentrated. So there just isn't a lot of price competition right now. Hospitals can charge kind of what they want, and insurers, because they're not facing competition, can just charge that, pass that price off in the form of a higher premium. So the bills are very different in how they structure the exchange, which is a way of approaching this problem. Aside from the public plan issue under the House bill, the exchange is set up in such a way that there would be more opportunity to lower premium costs over time. It's a federal exchange. It's a full replacement of the individual insurance market, as opposed to the Senate bill, which would allow the individual market to continue operating. And another very key provision in the House bill is it allows the commissioner of the exchange to negotiate premiums. It can reject premiums from carriers that it considers too high. It can reject premium increases. So there is some significant authority that exists in the House bill that is not quite as apparent in the Senate bill. So I think that this is a really big issue. It affects this premium trajectory that we see both individuals and the federal government paying over time. So I think that's going to be an important issue as this goes forward.
Yes, okay. We've got a maybe Deanne is the right person to kick off anyway in trying to respond to this question. It is decidedly non-academic. An average family earning $55,000 or $65,000 a year would have to pay $4,000 or $6,000 in premiums, let alone copays and other out-of-pocket expenses. What happens if they just can't afford that much without losing their homes or giving up other essential things? That is kind of the affordability question in its essence.
Well, if they can't afford it, I can't do the percentages off the top of my head that were there, but obviously we have the hardship exemption that people could, but then they end up without insurance. That's one of the problems of affordability, is you want people to be able to get the coverage, and these provisions that are really political reality, that there will be people because of their circumstances that they can't afford even a subsidized premium and with limits, they will end up without having insurance, paying a penalty, and you know, basically maybe a little bit worse off than they are right now. On the other hand, right now they face similar problems of not being able to afford anything that's out there. And so it's a dilemma. We have too many very low-income families in this country relative to the costs of the healthcare system and our ability to subsidize them.
Anybody else want to try that? One question that actually, I won't disguise it, I actually wrote this down myself as I was listening to Stuart talk. And it goes back to your argument, or the argument rather, for a Cadillac tax, if you will, and you properly pointed out some of the potential impact of that kind of a tax. And I know that a lot of economists are really quite positive about that provision, as maybe including Peter Rorzag, about that provision, because it is a way to give an incentive to move to more effective or efficient healthcare plans and ultimately bend the cost curve. And I wonder if you wanted to try to address that kind of an argument.
I don't think it's true to say that a lot of economists are enthusiastic about it. Certainly the ones I know, their first preference is for a very different arrangement. They tend to say, well, if we can't have what we really want, this is probably the second best, or maybe the third or fourth best solution. But as I said, the problem with a quote Cadillac tax is that it affects everybody who has coverage. It trickles down to everybody in the form of higher premiums throughout. The alternative approach is to say, let's look at the tax exclusion that people have, which is a very generous, as you go up the income level, an increasingly generous exemption from taxation, including payroll taxes as well as income taxes, for the value of your employer-based coverage. And I think the preferred approach of most health economists who are interested in the tax area is to say that that exclusion should be limited or capped for people above certain incomes who have plans above a certain cost. In other words, it's like an income-adjusted Cadillac tax, if it, maybe put it that way. And that could be what we eventually have. It would be a way of squaring this circle. If you do that, then a lower-income person who has generous coverage today would not pay more. On the other hand, because upper-income people, moderate and upper-income people in a firm, including its owners and so on, would face a higher level of tax penalty than they would even under the Cadillac tax in a lot of instances, they would have an incentive to start renegotiating the plan and organizing the plan differently. That's kind of the idea of that. I'm not getting into a lot of detail. The issue is which approach is more likely to not only raise revenue, which is part of the objective, but to get a sensible restructuring of plans. The argument that most economists say, unless that is felt individually in some way, rather than in a hidden way, implicitly like a Cadillac tax is, people won't in fact be open to change in their behavior and in negotiation. That's why you've got this issue, you know, of which is the better type of approach. I'm not sure that is as clear as it should be, but that's the issue at hand here. You want to get people to change their behavior, but if they don't sense that they as individuals are getting the burden of that tax, and they think of it as just somehow my premiums cost more, or over time actually my cash income is less because I don't even know how much my employer is paying, you're not going to get that acceptance of the kinds of changes that are necessary that an overt limit on the exclusion gets you, which is why politically the tax exclusion is a much harder sell because it is so obvious to people, whereas the Cadillac tax and the other taxes, premium taxes and taxes on certain services and so on, is easier to sneak in if your only objective is revenue, but you actually dull the effect on getting people to be open and to push for changes in the insurance structure itself.
I just wanted to add to what Stuart said about the excise tax. I think one important thing about that as a revenue source is that I think 80% of the revenue that it generates comes from this assumption that employers will stop offering these plans and that they will redirect the compensation through taxable income. So that is assuming a huge shift in the way employers are operating in the plans that employees are demanding. And it kind of begs the question, we are talking about the chronic conditions, what about the employers that are offering plans that just have a slightly older, sicker workforce? And so you're not looking at an actual Cadillac plan itself. You're just looking at perhaps a more basic plan that just happens to be more expensive. So there are some provisions to account for areas of the country that are higher cost, and there are some provisions to account for very high risk, you know, high cost professions, but probably not enough to address the fact that you could just have a generally older population that works for you and a more expensive population to insure. So I think that's going to be something that, you know, if this does make it through as a major revenue raiser, we definitely want to track over time and you know, make sure we have a sense of, you know, what influence this has had on and the plans that employers are offering and people are accepting.
Sounds like you were channeling our honorary chairman, the Senator, junior senator from West Virginia there, who has as constituents a lot of coal miners who are older and in a dangerous profession. We've got one last question. Are there any provisions in either the House or the Senate bill that you think are important or even crucial that are missing? Or some that you think are absolutely anathema that are present?
Yes.
I'm shocked. Do we have time for you to list
I
them?
Or,
what are your top three?
Well, let me put it, I'll say one thing generally, and it's not really actually in a sense an answer, but it is in another way. I think that a general issue is that in order to get the goals that we need to get, there have got to be big changes in the health system. I'm somebody, for example, who thinks that over time you have to see employer-based coverage essentially, if not disappearing in this country, certainly going down, and that people should be getting their coverage through an exchange system predominantly, properly designed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are other things. We've got to transfer funding in some way. People who've got very generous subsidies today, to get back to the tax item, there are people who have thousands and thousands of subsidies, people like Bill Gates, for example. And I don't think he really needs it. And there are people who don't. We've got to bring about big change. One of the general problems with this piece of these pieces of legislation, I think, is there's an attempt to sort of hide what you're really doing. And the more you do that, the more you come up with these incredibly sort of jerry-rigged processes like Cadillac taxes and so on that don't work the way you want. You're trying to sort of get savings whilst disguising what impact they're going to have. And I think that's what sort of gets you into this sort of constant briar patch that we have in healthcare, where people, you know, are really just pushing back and upset about it. So that's a way of answering what they're multiple, and they have a generic component, which is not really doing in an overt way what needs to be done, doing it in a covert way, and thereby having all these perverse impacts and inequities and so on that we've just been discussing.
I want to have a commercial for that before we leave.
Sure. My colleagues are waving this around. This was on the table out there. And I mentioned the Commonwealth Funds Commission on a high-performance health system. As I said before when we started, I think there are pieces in the House bill and the Senate bill that go a long way towards starting us down the road of high performance. And we clearly see universal coverage as the cornerstone to moving in that direction. There are certainly areas such as stronger payment policies and redesigning the way we pay that we think could go a lot further. Moving to a more integrated delivery system we think could help get us there, and we clearly see the payment changes as a way to drive the integration of that care. There's a lot of, like I said, a lot of things that go a long way. There's some things that we think are a good start and then stop just short of what we really need to actually to save significant dollars. It's not a coincidence, as Stuart mentioned, that things that save money are the things that are most difficult to do. So we put out a report in February called The Path to High Performance that if only everybody would pick up that report and put it into law, you could save $3 trillion over the course of time. The problem, though, is that they are the very things that make everybody kind of cringe and whinge when we're out talking to constituents. And it's that tension of the politically difficult things are the ones that are most likely to save real dollars, because you are talking about redistributing what we spend. And although, you know, I think we could all agree that we're not getting all the value we could out of the healthcare system right now, it is one of the pieces of our economy that continues to grow. In a lot of areas of the country, it's the only part of the economy that's really flourishing. So it's a difficult discussion to talk about redistributing resources, especially at a time of economic uncertainty. But a stronger payment provisions as a driver to reorganize the healthcare system, I think, is a piece that we'd like to see, and consider this just a down payment.
Deanne, do you have some final words?
Our question would be, are there enough changes in the competitive marketplace to change the way that insurance companies act so that they would start on their own beginning to make some of these kinds of changes? There's none of these delivery system, payment system, accountable care type suggestions that are in the law under the context of Medicare trying to test them out to see what works and doesn't. All of those things could be being done right now if the insurance industry had any reason to. And the assumption is that in no small measure is because they're not in a truly competitive marketplace. I don't know if that's right or not. I'm not qualified to. But, you know, we had the healthcare industry go to the White House in May or June, and say that they could save $2 trillion over 10 years. And you don't see that in this legislation anywhere. There's a hope and a prayer that you know, enough of this will incentivize them to do it. But it does raise that question, which is, does the legislation do enough to create the incentives or requirements or rewards to the various providers in the system to do some of the things that they could be doing and not wait for Medicare to prove out in 5 years?
Okay. Well, a very thoughtful comment at the end of a very thoughtful discussion that was not only thoughtful but also very detailed and precise at certain points. I think we understand maybe the reason for 1,800 of those 2,000 pages anyway is right. To try to encapsulate some of these details. I want to take this chance to thank our friends at the Commonwealth Fund, not just for helping us put this together, but obviously making big contributions to the quality of the conversation itself. Thank you for sticking through some pretty tough stuff to slog through for us non-economists, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for a very, very good discussion.